Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin in a moment and examine the explosive allegations levelled by Attorney General Holder at a press conference today, announcing the arrest of an Iranian-American involved in an alleged plot with Iran's Al-Quds force to assassinate the Saudi ambassador to the United States. Dr. Trita Parsi, the president of the National Iranian American Council, joins us to shed some light on this bizarre and reckless plot. Then we will speak with the former founder of Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps, Mohsen Sasagara, to try to understand who authorized such a brazen assassination of a close confidant of the Saudi king on American soil. We will discuss the reasons behind tensions between the Iranian regime and the Saudis as Iran suffers foreign policy setbacks in the region, with the Syrian regime it supports teetering and rival Turkey assuming a more assertive and leading role in the region. Then, with the latest Republican presidential debate underway, we will look into religious bigotry that may play a decisive role in whether Mitt Romney gets the nomination or not. A former insider in the right-wing evangelical movement, Frank Schaefer, joins us to discuss why Christian fundamentalists consider the Mormon Church a cult and why they will en masse vote for Governor Perry, who Mitt Romney has demanded should repudiate bigoted comments made by a pastor close to the Texas governor. Joining us now is Dr. Trita Parsi, who's a professor of international relations at Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. He is the co-founder and president of the National Iranian American Council and author of the upcoming book, A Single Roll of the Dice, Obama's Diplomacy with Iran. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Trita Parsi.
Thank you so much for having me, Ian.
And this is indeed a bizarre plot that Attorney General Holder announced today with the arrest of an Iranian American and the freezing of assets from the Treasury Department of a number of Revolutionary Guard Corps senior officials. What do you make of it on the surface? I mean, are the leadership there or factions within the leadership there this sort of reckless and brazen?
Well, let me first just start off by saying that I think the Iranian American community itself is completely abhorred by these accusations and what seems to have been a plot that involved an Iranian-American and some agents from the Islamic Republic. It's important to keep in mind that the vast majority of Iranian-Americans in this country are here in this country precisely because of their differences with the government in Iran and its activities. As to whether, they have done it or so, one thing that stands out that there's almost nothing ordinary about this story. The government of Iran, without a doubt, has had its involvement in terrorism, and mostly it's been targeting Iranian dissidents, including in faraway countries, and several of those killings have taken place in Europe, for instance. But a plot on U.S. soil, I don't think, has occurred since, I think it was 1980, when the Iranian revolutionaries ordered the killing of an Iranian diplomat by the name of Tabatabai in Washington, D.C. The killing itself apparently was conducted by an American, but it was on the order of the revolutionaries in Iran. Since then, I don't think there are any cases. So this would indicate that if all of these accusations and allegations are true, that it most likely is an escalation, or at least something of that order. And it is very difficult to see why the Iranians at this point would do something like this. Is it out of desperation? Was the entire Iranian government involved in this or not? It's a very, very strange case. But I think the consequences, however, are likely to be quite dire, because this is, as the State Department said, crossing a line. And I think the administration is signaling right now that it is likely to take some pretty drastic measures.
At this point, Dr. Trita Parsi, the Treasury Department has instigated sanctions against, of course, the person that was arrested, Mansour Ababasir, who's a naturalized U.S. citizen holding dual passports, the IRGC Quds Force commander Qasem Soleimani, Hamid Abdallahi, another senior IRGC QF official, Abdel Reza Shahali, who was apparently coordinating this operation, and Ali Gholam Shakouri, who was his deputy, who apparently actually met with the person that was arrested. That's what's happened so far. Do you expect more from the U.S. government?
Well, there's going to be a lot of pressures on the U.S. government to do more. And one thing that one should perhaps keep in mind is that mindful that this is a tremendously foolish and unwise thing that the Iranians have done, if all of these allegations are true, then the question arises, what is the intent of this? Is this because they wanted to escalate? Is it because they perhaps want to see a very strong response from the United States? Is this potentially a trap? And precisely because of that, if the Iranian government has done this and acted extremely unwisely, it makes it all the more important that the U.S. government thinks through every step very carefully and does not reply in kind by acting unwisely, but rather takes a very wise thorough approach in how to deal with this.
And in terms of the intelligence angle here, Dr. Tridipasi, it's hard to sort of figure out how the Drug Enforcement Administration got in the middle of this, but apparently they did. Now, you know, they were involved in the Victor Boot sting in Thailand, but, you know, drugs, guns, and money are a part of their portfolio. But, you know, assassination is something quite different. I take it the angle is this is the way that the plot was suggested, at least by the Attorney General in the press conference today, is that the plotters were going to get a Mexican drug cartel person to do the actual hit. Is that your understanding?
I'm not really sure about the details of the drug angle here. I think what is important to keep in mind is that, again, if these allegations are true and there's a usage of a Mexican inroad to the U.S. soil, bottom line is that you have some of these very intense rivalries in the Middle East, and particularly between Saudi Arabia and Iran, it's been extremely tense for the last couple of years. For instance, let's not forget that the very ambassador that, according to this plot, has been targeted here is the ambassador that played quite an extensive role in, according to the WikiLeaks, in pushing the United States to take military action against Iran. So if this is all true, then we're talking about a regional rivalry that is about to go out of control and that it may also have reached U.S. soil.
Well, given what's going on in Syria and that Iran and Saudi Arabia are on opposite sides there, there's obviously a lot of tinder out there that could, you know, that could invite a spark. My understanding is that what might be at the core of this is that the Iranians were their second biggest customer for oil is India, and with a 450,000 barrel a day demand, they haven't been able to pay for the oil because of international banking sanctions, and that Saudi Arabia stepped in and replaced the oil. So if Iran's lost its second biggest customer to Saudi Arabia, they've got to be feeling the pinch.
Well, there's a lot of different things going on. I don't think they have lost to Indians. Certainly the Saudis have gone to some of Iran's buyers and told them that if you stop buying from Iran, we'll sell the oil to you. Well, we have excess capacity. In an effort to isolate and contain Tehran, the Saudis have done this both with India and with China. But, you know, everywhere you go in the Middle East right now, Iran and Saudi Arabia are on opposite sides. The Saudis are supporting now the elements against the Assad regime in Syria, and Iran is standing by the Assad regime in Bahrain. Of course, the Iranians are in favor of the demonstrators, and there the Saudis went in themselves with 1,000 troops and clamped down on the protesters. And more so, just earlier this week, the Saudis came out with accusations against Tehran, saying that Tehran was behind some of the protests that actually had taken place inside of Saudi Arabia itself. Add to that that you have now had, in the last 2 years, several Iranian nuclear scientists assassinated in Iran, and the Iranians accused the U.S. and Israel being behind it. So you have a tremendous amount of tensions. You have killings taking place. You have, at the same time, a little bit of a breakdown of statecraft because increasingly many of the actors in the region, including the United States, are making their foreign policy decision based on domestic politics rather than on geopolitical calculus. And on top of that, there's almost no diplomacy between the contending parties, which then creates a situation in which the smallest spark can completely escalate out of control because there's no de-escalatory mechanisms in play.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Trita Pasi, who's a professor of international relations at Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies and co-founder and president of the National Iranian American Council. So along with Iran's and Saudi Arabia being on opposite sides in Syria, the Syrian regime, certainly if it's not teetering, it's under enormous pressure. And but for the vetoes from China and Russia would be even more isolated. Hamas seems to have abandoned Iran, and perhaps in some ways that may be play a part in the release today or the announcement of the release today of the Israeli corporal that's been held for a number of years. He's going to be exchanged for 1,000 Palestinian prisoners. So walk us through that. Is there a sense of paranoia and isolation that the leadership must be feeling if their foreign policy appears to be in tatters?
I think there's been clear signs that Tehran and its foreign policy apparatus in particular has been experiencing quite a lot of disorientation as a result of what's been happening with the Arab Spring. On many levels, of course, the Iranians were delighted to see the authoritarian regimes in Egypt and elsewhere fall, because these were certainly not states that were on good terms with Iran. But I think the Iranians were counting that these demonstrations and revolutions would also have a very strong anti-American component to them, something then that Iran could take advantage of. In almost all of the cases, the United States actually have not been much of a factor at all, and we've not seen strong expressions of anti-Americanism in those protests. So in a way, much of Iran's soft power, the basis for it, which primarily was its ability to take advantage of Arab frustrations against the United States, has diminished. And you have instead other states, such as Turkey, who have been able to really gain the momentum in the region, take the initiative. And now it's Turkey that is far strongly rising in the region, whereas Iran in many ways has lost its momentum. When things like that happen, it's a typical pattern in which you see states take desperate measures. So far from the Iranians, I would say that the desperate measures have been limited to their rhetoric, such as the statement coming out two or so weeks ago from one of the Navy commanders saying that they're going to be sending ships to Iranian Navy ships to outside of the U.S.'s coast. But if this allegation is true, then we may see that this desperation may have escalated beyond just rhetoric.
So could it be, Trita Pasi, that the desperation is really directed at their for internal consumption? Since this plot doesn't make any sense unless the Iranians are trying to provoke the Americans into attacking them, which they probably, in a curious way, would this regime would welcome an attack from the U.S. and or Israel. That's one possibility. The other possibility, of course, is their desperation with keeping a lid on at home and feeding into that sort of notion that you've got to support us because of tensions from abroad.
There has, without a doubt, been a pattern, at least in the past. It's difficult to say if that's the case now. But in the past, there has been a pattern in which this regime, when feeling threatened internally, has tried to diverge the population's attentions by creating or taking advantage of tensions that existed with its external players. This is also part of the reason why the Bush administration's very bellicose approach was not effective and in many ways benefited the regime, because the regime welcomed that level of tension in order to be able to securitize the internal atmosphere and clamp down on its own internal critics. Is this plot a part of that? It's difficult to tell. I mean, there's part of, one could definitely make the argument that if the Iranians truly wanted to go after the Saudis by making an assassination, they could have easily done so elsewhere in the world. There was not much of a need for them to come to the United States. So if these allegations are true, the fact that it was then being plotted to take place in the U.S. has to have a reason for it. There's something they're either trying to cause or to try to signal. And it's, again, as I mentioned earlier on, a very dangerous situation, and particularly mindful of the fact that there is no functioning diplomacy, these things can easily get out of control.
So just in closing, Trita Parsi, do you think that this regime is losing a grip? If this is true, if they're trying to do something this brazen and reckless, it would suggest that there's a level of desperation. We haven't heard a lot from the Green Movement, and there's the expression from the Nobel laureate Shirin Ebadi the embers are burning under the ashes. Where does that stand?
Well, without a doubt, the regime remains extremely unpopular, just because the Green Movement have not necessarily been able to be as visible or taking out to the streets or things of that nature does not mean that the population is now suddenly content with the regime. On the contrary, I think that they're tremendously discontent, not only because of the lack of political freedoms, but because of the state of the economy, the corruption, the incompetence, and many other things. So it's not that the population have changed their mind. I think the population is waiting for opportunities. And there may very well be significant concerns within the regime. And there's also another factor, and that is that the Iranian Revolutionary Guards, according to most analysts, have gained a tremendous amount of influence over the last couple of years, and they're increasingly involved in decision-making. And they have added a significant military dimension to the foreign policy-making. When you have military units making foreign policy decisions, then you have a militarized foreign policy. And I think there are signs that that is the direction that the Iranian government is going as a result of the changes that have taken place within its own composition.
Which is exactly what Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said some time back. I thank you for joining us, Dr. Trita Parsi.
Thank you so much for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Trita Parsi, who is a professor of international relations at Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. He's the co-founder and president of the National Iranian American Council and author of the upcoming book, A Single Roll of the Dice, Obama's Diplomacy with Iran. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking to a founder of the Revolutionary Guard Corps, the very people involved, at least in a branch of them, the Quds Force, very people involved in this bizarre assassination plot.
The Bible's blood and toys, that the Koran is new. If you burn them all together, you get close to the truth still. They're pouring over Sanskrit under Ivy League moons, while shadows lengthen in the sun. Cast on a school of meditation built to soften the times and hold us at the center of the spiraling lines. It's knocking over fences, crossing property lines, pulling.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Mohsen Sazegara. He is an Iranian journalist and pro-democracy political activist who was a founder of the Iranian Revolutionary Guards and held several high-ranking positions during the early years of the Iranian Revolution, serving as Deputy Prime Minister for Political Affairs, Deputy Minister for Heavy Industry, Deputy Chairman of the Budget and Planning Department, and before many other positions before becoming disillusioned in 1989. He applied to become a candidate for president of Iran in 2001 elections and was refused. His reformist policies clashed with the Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei, eventually resulting in his arrest. And after his release in August of 2003, he now resides in the United States. We're talking to you from Paris today, Dr. Sazagara. And in Washington today, of course, the Attorney General Eric Holder held a press conference where he announced the arrest of a Iranian-born U.S. naturalized citizen, and suggesting that he was a part of a $1.5 million plot to blow up the Saudi embassy, perhaps the Israeli embassy, and to kill the Saudi ambassador to the United States. And, of course, this will lead to further sanctions. Given that the Al-Quds force is implicated here, and specifically Gholam Shakouri, who is apparently based in Iran, he was the instigator of the plot. You, of course, being one of the founders of the IRGC, the Quds force is a part of that. What's your understanding of the operational control here? Who would have been giving, who would have come up with this plot, and who would have sanctioned it?
First of all, I have to say that that Revolutionary Guard, that I was one of the founders of that organization, was not this Revolutionary Guard. We hoped on those days to create a people army to defend the country. But so naturally, we did not have any Quds force, any terror division, or other things that on these days Revolutionary Guard is doing in Iran or outside Iran. Anyway, Quds force is one of the forces of Revolutionary Guard which is in charge of out of Iran operations. Most of them terroristic actions in Iraq, in Lebanon, in Somalia, in Argentina, everywhere in the world, all around the world. And this plot, which was announced by General Prosecutor of the United States, is something which shows that they have planned something against Saudi Arabia because of the several difficulties that they have on these days with Saudi Arabia in that region.
So would these orders have been sanctioned by the Supreme Leader? I don't think Ahmadinejad is in the loop, is he?
Definitely, because, you know, according to the constitution of Iran, the leader is the chief commander of all armed forces of Iran and police of Iran, and president is only head of the government and has no responsibility about what armed forces do, especially Revolutionary Guard. And inside Revolutionary Guard, Quds force directly report to the leader of Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei, and the commander of Revolutionary Guard, General Qasem Soleimani, is a person that every time that he wants directly, he goes to the house of the leader, meets him, and reports to him directly. So I believe that this operation, which have been designed inside Revolutionary Guard, Intelligence Division of Revolutionary Guard under command of Hossein Taher, has been reported to the to Ayatollah Khamenei and has been under his command directly.
So, again, I'm speaking with Dr. Moshe Sazagara, who was one of the founders of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, and we're talking about the plot announced today by the U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder, involving a transfer of $1.5 million, $100,000 of which was transferred to 56-year-old naturalized U.S. citizen Mansour Arabsiyar, who has dual Iranian and U.S. passports, along with Gholam Shakouri, who is a member of Iran's Quds force. And the plot was, of course, aimed at the Saudi Arabian ambassador. And you were saying, Mohsen, that the Iranian regime is having problems with the Saudis. Give us an understanding of why they would resort to such reckless measures. What is it that's really upsetting them?
They're upset, first of all, because of Bahrain. In Bahrain, Saudi Arabia has helped the regime of Bahrain to suppress Shia opposition over there, which Iran supports them. Although this support of Iran did not really help the Shias in Bahrain. Anyway, second, they have problem in Iraq. Saudi Arabia is not happy with whatever Iran is doing in Iraq, and have more influence than before in Iraq. And third, which is the important part, is Syria. In Syria, Iran supports the regime of Assad to suppress the people of Syria. This is not what these days all Arab states support. That they prefer to support people of Syria. But I believe that the main problem with Saudi Arabia goes to oil exportation of Iran. As you know, Iran is under sanctions of the United States, so Iran has serious difficulties in oil industries, in oil projects, because of the U.S. sanctions on banking system against Iran, sometimes, like the case of India, Iran is not able to receive the money of the oil that exports. And Saudi Arabia is the only country which has the capability to export oil instead of Iran to other countries, cheaper and better oil. It happened with respect to India about 2 or 3 months ago. So oil exportation is the Achilles heel of the regime of Iran. So I guess that by this operation, they wanted to send a serious message to Saudi Arabia that they don't tolerate Saudi Arabia to substitute oil exportation of Iran.
So they've lost India as a customer. That was, I think, their biggest customer, wasn't it?
One of the biggest. India imports 450,000 barrels per day from Iran. I'm not sure, but I guess around these days, China is the biggest customer.
I see. So, Dr. Mohsen Sazagara, let's just look at the world from the point of view of the supreme leader of Iran, who clearly is, along with the Quds Force, are acting in a paranoid manner, given the kind of brazen nature of this plot to blow up the Saudi embassy, the Israeli embassy in Washington, D.C., and to kill the Saudi ambassador to the United States. They're losing the Syria, and by extension, they will lose Hezbollah, right, because they're linked to Hezbollah. They're losing Hamas because of what's happening in Syria. And what about their efforts in to stir up trouble into Saudi Arabia? What does the Shia diaspora think of this regime? Because I can't imagine, since the Green Revolution was crushed, that too many people have any illusions about the nature of this regime in Tehran.
Yes, you're right. You know, the leader of Iran should be very disappointed on these days because he thought that he can be the leader of the world of Islam. And he can see on these days that Turkey is now the real leader of the world of Islam. Recep Tayyip Erdogan goes to every country, thousands of people in Tunisia, in Libya, they come to welcome him. And model of Turkey, I mean a kind of democracy, is now more favored amongst the Muslim nations than model of Iran, which is an Islamic revolution. But many investments, Iran, especially Quds Force, they have had amongst the Shia minorities in Islamic countries, including Saudi Arabia. But they lost Shia minorities, even Shia minorities, because of the Green Movement of Iran. And many of the Shia Arab people saw on TVs, Arab TVs, that this regime suppressed the Iranian Shia people, and people of Iran, especially young generation, they don't like this regime. And they are beaten, they are imprisoned, they are killed by this regime. I remember that about 2 years ago, during the holy day of Shia people, Ashura, when they killed 38 persons in that day to suppress the demonstration on that day, I remember that I was informed that Qasem Soleimani, commander of Quds Force, he went to Ayatollah Khamenei and explained to the leader that by these scenes on the streets of Tehran, which have been broadcasted by all Arab TVs and all satellite TVs all around the world, we have lost even the Shia people. So you're right, the leader of Iran can be really, really disappointed on these days, because whatever he has invested in foreign policy of Islamic Republic in whole region is now bankrupted.
And does he know this? Is he getting information, or is he?
I've got information from my sources that privately he has said that yes, it's a really, really disappointing situation and dangerous situation. He's afraid of changing, because now there is a domino of democracy in Middle East. And as you know, Iranian people shouted on the streets that Mubarak Ben Ali, Nobatete said Ali. It means that Mubarak Ben Ali, and now it's your turn, Sayyid Ali, which is the first name of Ayatollah Khamenei. So he really hates to be mentioned as another dictator in region, to be in the queue, to be overthrown. But the truth is that the people of Iran and many other countries evaluate him as another dictator who is in the queue to be overthrown by the people.
The Russians and the Chinese vetoed sanctions against Syria. And that situation, it's very hard to understand why the United States has been sort of ambivalent about Syria, as has Israel, as a matter of fact, when it is so obvious that Iran is supporting the Assad regime. They've apparently pumped about, $8 to $10 billion in there to prop them up. That's real money. So what do you think is happening back home as Iran suffers these foreign policy defeats? Do the Iranian people know this? Are they embarrassed by their government? I remember on the day where they celebrate, I think it's called Palestinian Day. A lot of the people in the street were saying, why are we supporting the Palestinians and not taking care of our own people? And now that they've lost Hamas and they are likely to lose Hezbollah and Syria, surely that's going to have domestic repercussions.
I'm pretty sure that the regime of Iran will claim that this is a fake story. It's a fabricated story. And the U.S. Wants to cover the domestic problems, because in Iran, if you live in Iran, every day you can see, you can watch in TV that Iran shows, that TV of Iran and radio and TV, state-run TV of Iran shows that yes, U.S. has lots of troubles and everything is bankrupted. They are going to lose everything. And so in Iran, the regime's propaganda will claim that this story is a fake story, fabricated story. They will claim that U.S. has created that to cover their defeats in domestic policies, especially economy. And they, I'm pretty sure that they will claim that at most this is something to show to Iran that U.S. wants to revenge those two hikers in imprisonment for 2 years. So this is how they try to propagate inside Iran. But what people will believe, it depends on that how they receive the information. As you know, we have only one state-run radio and television. Of course, it has six stations, TV stations, but they are all under one organization, under control of the leader of Iran. And they have tried, although we have 36.5 million internet users in Iran, but Revolutionary Guard controls telecom of Iran, and they have filtered lots of the websites, and even they have closed VPNs, and they try to prevent, to ban the information circulation for Iran. I can't say that how much they will succeed to ban the real information to go to Iran with respect to this plot. Especially that during the last 2 or 3 months, they have started to attack to every house to collect the dishes for satellite TVs, because we have several Persian language satellite TVs. But I'm not sure that the regime succeeds to, you know, control the information circulation for people of Iran. What I can say is that it's more than 2 or 3 years or even more that people of Iran don't trust the official propaganda of the regime.
Just in closing then, the Saudis are going to be very upset about this. I'm not sure what they can do, but this is clearly going to lead to more tension in the region. Just in the last few seconds, do you think that this regime is going to last, its days are numbered, the theocratic regime?
You know, Saudis, they have very, very conservative foreign policy. I heard from one of my friends a few minutes ago that they are really shocked right now.
The Saudis. The Saudis you're talking about.
Because they didn't think that Iran may go for such a plot against their ambassador or their embassy, especially this ambassador, Mr. Adel Al Jubeir, is very, very close to the king, and it's a very favorite diplomat for the king himself. So I believe that it will help Saudis to get closer to the United States, because they were angry with the United States, especially with events in Egypt. And they may become more serious to follow the policy of oil exportation to substitute Iran markets, to cover Iran markets, to show to Iran that they are really serious about that. But we have to wait and see that what will be the real reaction of the Saudi officials.
Sure, but you said earlier that oil is Iran's Achilles heel, and if their exports dry up, this government will have a hard time staying in power. I thank you for joining us, Dr. Mohsen Sazegara.
Well, thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Mohsen Sazegar, an Iranian journalist and pro-democracy political activist. He is one of the founders of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, and we spoke to him from Paris. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Frank Schaefer, who is a best-selling author of fiction and nonfiction. His parents, Francis and Edith Schaefer, were world-famous evangelical speakers and authors. He previously worked with such figures as Pat Robinson, Jerry Falwell, and Focus on the Family's James Dobson. Frank Schaefer increasingly experienced a crisis of faith and broke with the evangelical movement. His novels include Crazy for God, Patience with God, and his latest, Sex, Mum, and God. Welcome to Background Briefing, Frank Schaefer.
Hi, thanks, Ian.
And Frank, you've been watching the latest Republican presidential debate, which began, and as our program began today, so I haven't had an opportunity to watch it. Not that it's my favorite viewing, but I sometimes have to do my homework here. What's happened so far? Because I expected there to be a little friction over Mitt Romney has already called on Perry to repudiate bigoted remarks made by his pastor.
About Mormonism. No, there's been no mention of that. What we've seen is essentially a series of statements on the economy and the government. But there is a theme that actually connects to things you and I have talked about in the past. And that is really the theme of this book of mine, Sex, Mom, and God, on how the religious right arose. And that is all of these candidates posture on pointing to the federal government, the U.S. government, as the agent of all problems in our culture. And so what you really have here is a Republican Party that is controlled by a right-wing ideology that is anti-government, and really fundamentally anti-American while wrapping itself in the flag is, I think anything in our history. So, Michelle Bachmann, first of all, early in the debate, blamed the federal government and essentially pushed the idea that it should be virtually shut down. Gingrich attributed all of our problems to the Federal Reserve and intimated that Bernanke and people like him should be in jail. In response to a question about if anything should be done about Wall Street, he said, Wall Street's not the problem. The federal government is the only problem. Wall Street's not the problem. The same theme was picked up across the board. And so really, I would just say, if you were trying to figure a headline to describe the Republican debate, it would be Republicans delegitimize all government. And, of course, that goes back to things I was involved with that I talk about in Sex, Mom, and God back in the 70s and 80s, which was the way we would portray the federal government as the agent of all evil because we disagreed with decisions on abortion or gay rights. This is now translated into an across-the-board hatred of the federal government by Republican candidates that, of course, gives free rein to Wall Street and deregulation of all kinds. And so you really see in this debate tonight the complete merging of two movements, the religious right suspicion and hatred of the federal government because it allowed abortion, gay rights, and so forth, combined with this laissez-faire economic approach that says, look, we need no taxes virtually, no regulation. Rick Perry's only economic proposal that he made tonight concretely was to open up every gas and oil and energy field in America to production. He said that would create 1.5 million jobs, and that's all he has for the economy, again blaming the federal government. and so forth. So tonight, you know, the overall theme was not a petty squabble over religion and bigotry of being anti-Mormon, although that's very interesting because the evangelicals are not going to vote for a Mormon candidate. But it was the most glaring statements of just anti-government venom that you're going to hear, you know, this side of Al-Qaeda. You know, the only other people who talk this way about the U.S. federal government and its nefarious designs on the world are the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, the Iranian government, and so forth. And so, you know, to see this coming out of the Republican Party is really shocking.
And Frank Schaefer, the when you say that religious aspect and the bigotry towards Mormonism is one that's not being discussed tonight, even though in the lead up to it there was you know, both Perry and Romney were firing shots across each other's bows about
right.
It's nevertheless, though, critical, because if as you say, the religious right, who you know very well, will not vote for this Mitt Romney, they aren't they incredibly influential in the primary process, and doesn't,
oh, yeah. I mean,
doesn't
look,
that make him toast?
Yeah, they the agitators that used to be at the gates of the Republican Party back when my dad and I in the 70s were agitating on behalf of the anti-abortion movement are now the very people running. You know, Michelle Bachmann was quoted in the New Yorker a few weeks ago as saying the only reason she got into politics was because of the documentary series of films I directed against abortion that featured my father back in the 1970s. And so now we have a sort of a second and third generation of activists who have come up through the ranks of the religious right. You have to understand, when they look at Mormonism, they look at it the same way they look at atheism or the same way they would look at Hindus. In fact, I facetiously mentioned on Rachel Maddow's show a couple of nights ago that, you know, as far as they're concerned, this would be a choice between the Mormon, in quote, if it was Mitt Romney, and the Muslim, in quote, which is, you know, a consistent lie they've told about President Obama. And all joking aside, that's how the evangelical gatekeepers who now control the nominating process with the votes that they've locked up on the whole idea of who could become a candidate, let alone who would be president. Now, in the national election, I don't think that would hold. And I don't even think it would hold with many evangelical Christians who would be more open-minded. But we're talking about the hardcore activists, that 60% of the Tea Party, for instance, which is shown to be right-wing evangelical in the Pew Research poll that was done. Those group of people who sent, you know, the 87 radical freshmen into Congress to stall the Obama presidency virtually completely, those group will not tolerate and will not vote for a Mormon. And so essentially the Republicans have a real problem because their heartbeat is controlled by a bigoted inner core of right-wing fundamentalist Christians who regard Mormons as not just heretics, but you know, as complete non-Christians and non-starters and would never vote for one.
Well, Frank Schaefer, it's been pretty obvious for some time that there's something wrong with Mitt Romney in as much as he's not catching on. It's not the first time that he's run.
Right.
He looks presidential. He acts, you know, he's got all of the right telegenic moves, but somehow he's not connecting. And it's also equally obvious, I think, that the Republican establishment desperately want him, and that I think, that, except for the oil barons in Texas and Oklahoma, who support Perry, I think the business establishment is quite alarmed by Perry. So are you saying that the Christian fundamentalists in their lockstep control of the primary process have the clout and have the numbers to deny Mitt Romney the nomination?
Because I believe they do. I mean, you could always have a freakish turn of events that casts some unforeseen factor into the race, both the national race but also just the primaries. But other than that, other than something completely unforeseen, I would say the contingency, you know, as Jeeves would have said in the P.G. Woodhouse books, the contingency is remote, that this guy could ever be a Republican candidate in a world where you have to be a fundamentalist evangelical Christian to have a prayer or pretend you are one. Now, a guy like Newt Gingrich isn't going to get it in, but at least, you know, as a kind of a recent convert to Catholicism, he can kind of pretend that he's in lockstep with the values of the religious right and get away with it, because Catholics have been slightly rehabilitated from the kind of whore of Babylon label that John Hagee, who was a big supporter of McCain, gave them. But when you get to Mormonism, it's right out there with in the evangelical mind with Islam. And it's not just a derivative of Christianity, but a false religion, a twisted religion, a horrible thing, a perversion that God hates. That's the way evangelical Christians look at Mormonism. And there's a huge literature. You just Google evangelical writing on Mormonism, and you're going to come up with thousands of books, pamphlets, essays, denouncing it in the most vile terms. So they have a real problem, because the front runner for the economic interests is someone who is part of a religion that, with all the flip-flopping he's done on things like abortion, he can't flip-flop on this one, and he is not going to be looked upon favorably by any of these hard right-wing evangelical fundamentalists at the very core of the movement. And these guys control the process.
And so this means then, Frank Schaefer, this is pretty much a foregone conclusion then. I mean, and they can have 100 debates, right? They're not going to change their mind.
I think the movers and shakers know this. And you know, people like Roger Ailes at Fox knows it. Rupert Murdoch knows it. They're probably having meetings and scrambling around in the back trying to figure, you know, what the hell they're going to do, because they don't have a candidate that business is going to like in a Rick Perry, let alone a Michelle Bachmann. And what they've got is a problem, because their most presentable looking candidate in terms of chemistry is someone who will never catch on with the rank and file Republican voter, because the rank and file Republican voter believes the Earth is 6,000 years old, that evolution is a myth, that there is no global warming, that foreign policy in Israel has to be dictated by the imminent return of Jesus, which is why Obama is so evil in their view for even talking about making peace with the Palestinians, because it would give away Judea and Samaria to the Arabs and prevent Jesus from coming back. We're dealing with the people who literally are the idiot fringe, the lunatic fringe of American society. But they now have locked up the control of the nominating process of our other major party, which is no longer a normal political party, but is really a religious party. And so what you really see in the Republican Party is religion masquerading as politics. And I don't think that sinks in most people. I'll repeat it. You know, this is not politics. It's religion masquerading as politics. And that's the nominating process. And the social agenda goes far past Roe v. Wade and abortion now. It's to discredit the federal government, to replace it with a kind of a theocratic view of America. You know, the code word for that is American exceptionalism. Well, we're exceptional because God somehow chose us, so we're the new chosen people. The laws of the Bible should apply and should be over and above the rule of law, in terms of the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, etc. This is the view of the core that now controls the nominating process of the Republican Party. And so people who I knew in the past and worked with, as I talk about in my book, Sex, Mom, and God, folks like Jack Kemp, William F. Buckley, all these guys, President Ford, Betty Ford, who was a friend of my mother's, et cetera, you know, you could agree or disagree with any of these people on policy, even Ronald Reagan to a certain extent, but none of them could be mistaken for right-wing evangelical true believers. You know, these were ordinary American citizens with conservative views, but that's where it ended. Now it's a whole new game. And so there are some true believers like Rick Perry and Michelle Bachmann who are literally part of the lunatic fringe themselves. And then there are people who have got to pretend they agree with them on the social litmus test issues, but if they're Mormons, they're totally unacceptable to this group and will never, never, never get the nomination.
Well, it's clear that Perry's feeding this idea, you know, through the back door. He started his campaign by basically having a big revival meeting down in Houston and saying, I'm not a Mormon.
Right.
And that's the, clearly the subtext. We haven't heard the latter part of the, because we've been talking here, what happened in the debate. But I, it sounds to me, just in closing, Frank, that, that Perry doesn't have to do much, you know, just show up and not fall off the stage. And he'll win this thing.
And then you have some people who, you know, we don't know about, like Herb Cain and these guys.
What an ignoramus and a bigot and a buffoon. Anyway, I think.
the thing is, the Republicans are so controlled by ideological litmus tests at their core now that the freakish things they could throw out as an alternative candidate remains to be seen.
We're out of time here, and I thank you so much for joining us. Frank,
always a pleasure, Ian. Thanks a lot.
Again, I've been speaking with Frank Schaefer, whose parents, Francis and Edith Schaefer, were world-famous evangelicals. He is the author of a number of books, the latest being Sex, Mom, and God. So what did we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we began talking about the announcement today by the Attorney General that there was an Iranian plot to kill the Saudi ambassador in Washington. On the surface, it seems extraordinary and reckless, and almost impossible to believe. But we tried to look into it and spoke with Dr. Trita Parsi, the president of the National Iranian American Council, largest group of Iranian Americans. He, of course, was nervous and wanted to say up front that, Iranian Americans are patriots and they don't, in any way want to be associated with this kind of terrorist action. But he did go on to say how this government in Tehran is desperate. It's losing ground in terms of its foreign policy and could well be desperate enough, both afraid of the Green Movement at home and of its foreign policy reversals abroad. I then spoke with one of the founders of the Revolutionary Guard Corps, the very people involved in this plot, the Al-Quds group, a branch of it is called Al-Quds, Moshe Sazagara. He believes that there really is quite a kind of cold war going on between Iran and Saudi Arabia, and mostly to do with oil, that the Saudis, India was the second biggest customer of Iranian oil, but because of banking sanctions, the money couldn't be transferred. So Saudi Arabia stepped in and said, we'll replace the Iranian oil and, in fact, give you better quality oil. And apparently that's happening across the board. So it's possible that not just the tensions in Syria, where Saudi Arabia is backing one side and Iran the other, there may be a lot more to this, although still it seems bizarre that they would want to pull off something so brazen. We were speaking today, of course, in the same time slot as the latest Republican debate, and I wanted to talk about bigotry, religious bigotry, the subtext of much of what Perry is suggesting, or at least his surrogates are, that Mormonism is a cult. To get a sense of what Perry's chances are, or what Romney's chances are, since he's a Mormon, I spoke with Frank Schaefer. His parents were famous evangelicals. He says basically that Mitt Romney is toast. He is never going to get the votes of the religious right, and they control the primary process. And it's that simple. That as long as Perry doesn't fall off the stage, he's got the nomination wrapped up, and that's freaking out the Republican establishment. This has been a Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I would like to thank Graham Fitzgibbons, producer. This program is available at ianmasters.com. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Just